Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms. It's Sunday, April 27th, 2014. Welcome to episode 73 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now. And my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? Will I ever find my way back?
TRCR is a podcast about retro computers for retro computers, but humans are allowed to listen too. And speaking of humans, I'm joined by three of them today. So let's do that intro voodoo that I do so well. First up, his feet are in Portland, but his head is in Mississippi. He's bad, he's nationwide. He's Earl Evans. Hello, Earl.
Carrington.
Yes,
I have a 50,000 watt microphone and I'm not scared to use it.
I'm scared of you using it. Next up, we also have another fellow. What can I say about him? Well, his name is one from ancient Viking times. Yes, there were in fact many Vikings named Paul. It's Paul Hagstrom. Hello, Paul.
Good day. If only I knew how to say good day in the Viking speak.
You just hit me with a hammer or something.
Right.
It's universal for the Vikings. All things are hit them with a hammer, hit them with an axe. And finally, we will rotate the globe so that it is the correct side up, and we find our next host traveling in a fried-out combi on a hippie trailhead full of zombie. It is Michael Mulhern. Hello, Michael.
G'day, mate.
Did I get the lyric correct?
Pretty close.
Pretty close, okay.
It was only 100%.
Oh, excellent. Well, I know that combi is combi with a K, so because it's based on that combi van or something you guys had down there.
Yeah, the V-dub, yeah.
There you go. See, I know what I'm talking about, kind of. I can fake it. But we're not here to talk about old automobiles. We are here to talk about old computers. And in fact, we're going to begin by saying happy birthday to one very old computer and one very old technology. And let's do the technology first. 1st of May is the 50th birthday of BASIC. Now, this was news to me. I actually thought BASIC was older than this. But according to a couple of sources that have been thrown into our show notes by my disreputable co-hosts, BASIC, B-A-S-I-C, the language, is about to turn 50 years old. So let's start with a discussion of that. Not it turning 50, but maybe about when we first encountered BASIC early on. And I bet you all of us had something to do with BASIC. So Earl, why don't we start off with you? What is your earliest memory of BASIC?
It would be Integer BASIC on the Apple II.
Really?
Yes.
It surprises me that it's an Apple II.
Well, like I've said a couple of times, my middle school instructor was such a nice guy that he brought his Apple II into the classroom and let us crazies bang on it. And I love him for that to this day. And it was a really interesting experience after dealing with punch cards and mark sense cards and other stuff like that to sit at a machine and have it react right back to you. I loved that the BASIC was interactive. I loved everything about it, the way it did things. And I can't overstate its significance in terms of it reeling me into a life in computing.
I am with you on that. Paul, what about you? What was your introduction to the lovely language of BASIC?
Well, I think we're going to have a fairly consistent show on this question. I was an AppleSoft BASIC person. I didn't have
newbie.
Much time with. Yes, exactly. But very early, pretty much the first thing I did with any computer was a little programming exercises in AppleSoft BASIC. drawing lines and, you know, little scenes in the graphics of the time. I spent a little bit of time on friends' computers. One of the things I think is kind of neat about this is that BASIC is more or less BASIC. I mean, it's not exactly BASIC everywhere, but you can go to the Commodore 64 that your friend has, or your other friend's TRS-80, and, you know, more or less get something going. So, but my first experience was in elementary school with an Apple II Plus.
So, 2-for-2 for the Apple II. Michael, are you going to split the field or keep it unanimous? What was your introduction to BASIC?
Well, I'm sorry to upset all our listeners, but I too learned BASIC for the first time on an Apple II. It was the AppleSoft BASIC. I'm even newer to the field. I didn't touch a Apple II computer until about 1981. So integer BASIC was something even then a bit of a throwback. Had to load that into the machine to use it. But floating point BASIC, that's where I started. Same thing, drawing lines and doing cute little things when I was supposed to have been doing statistical work up in the Apple lab and the computer science area. But quickly moved on to writing games and other little utilities. Still not doing what I was supposed to be doing in the tute room.
I find it remarkable that me, the notorious Apple bigot that I am going to be the one who has a different answer. Apple did not introduce me to BASIC. I did fiddling around little bits of BASIC on both TRS-80 Model 1 and a PET at school prior to getting hands-on with an Apple II. So it wasn't actually my introduction. The Apple II was my introduction to fully loving computing and diving in headfirst and, you know, turned me into the frothing bigot that I am. But it was before that. Really, it was, I would say, the Model 1 that kind of made me fall in love with BASIC programming, because I got some real hands-on time with it and got to spend real time with the machine and develop my first programs that were my own from scratch rather than typing in other listings as I had done on the PET. So for me, it was absolutely the TRS-80 that got me into BASIC. Although, from then on, for quite a few computers, it was one of my go-to fun languages. If you wanted to knock out something or just play, it was BASIC. When I wanted speed, it was, say, Assembler or something else. And eventually C became my great love of languages and all the things that have been derived from it. But I think one of the big, most important things about BASIC at the end of the day are what does BASIC stand for again? Beginners, all-purpose?
Symbolic is in there.
Oh, symbolic instruction code. Ah, that was it. I knew you guys would do it. It was something like that. But the point, I think, there is the idea for beginner, the idea that we're going to have a language that you would start with. Now, that has become a hot topic today. Like, do you need – is BASIC actually easier than other languages? Is BASIC easier than Perl? Was it ever actually easier than assembly language or something like that? And, you know, lots of people argue all sides of that. But I do think that one of the things that marks BASIC as being one of the most important languages ever is that it was so many people's first language. And mostly, it was the language that came with computers. And I would think in some ways maybe the most accessible language that came with computers. Kids could fire it up. And whether or not we want to argue that assembly language wasn't actually more difficult or what have you, or Pascal or C or what do you want, BASIC had the reputation, at least, of being approachable. And it was the language that was everywhere. You turned on your computer, you could type it in. You got any magazine, it had listings, and they were BASIC. BASIC was the accessible language. I would argue maybe the first big language for the masses. Now, what do you guys think about that? Like, I know it's a bit of a hot button, but let's go around the table here. Maybe start with you, Earl, and maybe just touch on the idea that what are we missing today, if anything, from the fact that when you turn on a computer, there is no actual BASIC equivalent anymore? Because I would think that there isn't. You turn on a modern PC, a modern Mac, it isn't just you can knock out something in BASIC. I think that's fundamentally something that's changed from the 80s. What say you?
I think that there is an interactive and educational component that we lack now. One piece of evidence for that is the emphasis on Python on the Raspberry Pi. You know, the Raspberry Pi came out to serve the educational world, and of course lots of tinkerers and, you know, everybody's kind of glommed onto it because it's so cool. But a lot of the stuff that you do with the Raspberry Pi, you do in Python. And I would argue that Python shares a lot of the characteristics of BASIC. It's interactive. It's an interpreted language. It is approachable. You can do some simple things simply, but then if you want to do more sophisticated things, you have libraries and such to do that. So that feels to me like an implicit recognition that we still need something like BASIC, like a lingua franca, to introduce people to computers in an approachable way.
Now, do you think people actually, I'm going to want to go around the table here, but I'm going to grill each of you in turn. So get ready for it, guys. So Earl, I'm going to play devil's advocate with all of you. Is it the case that most people want that though? Back in the day, if you had a computer in 1984, you were probably a nerd. You were probably interested in creating your own stuff. You were a tinkerer, you were a hobbyist or what have you. My mother and my sister and my coworkers and the vast majority of people who use computers nowadays, I think, are not in that category. Do they need it? Does my mother need access to something like BASIC?
Perhaps not. Perhaps not. But
what do you think about my mother, Earl?
But I think
I'm going to stand for that.
I think, though, that taking away the element of programmability has had a cost, because people now don't understand that things you do over and over and over on your computer, you could actually get some mileage out of scripting or programming. Mm-hmm. You can do some automation type things. I mean, back in the day you're talking about, that's kind of all you could do. But now you do the same things over and over and over. Well, you could write a script for that, but people don't even think about that. I've tried to tell my kids, both of whom are interested in going into some area of engineering or another, I said, you know, you don't have to be a computer programmer, but you should learn how to script some things and learn some things about programming, because the people who can use these the most effectively as a tool are the people who are going to have an edge on other people in their field, no matter what your field is. If you can dance with the computer a little bit more eloquently, mm-hmm. you're going to win.
Nice. Dance with the computer. Okay, Paul, we're going to turn the spotlight on you. If I make the statement that computers today are lacking something equivalent to BASIC, at least as they come out of the box, is that true? Are we missing anything because of that? What say you?
Yeah, I think, so I know that one of the things that I believe I've said this before, actually, at some point in the past, but for me, perhaps because I just started this way, I think in BASIC. You know, if I want to do something very quickly, if I want to do something that's a computation or something like that requires a little bit of variables and looping, I have been known to just, you know, start an Apple II emulator specifically so I can just write this thing in, you know, the 2 minutes that I have rather than try to figure out, you know, how to do this in something like Python or whatever. After having done that, I looked around a little bit, and this too may have been mentioned before, but there is a modern BASIC called Chipmunk BASIC that you can install, which could do all those same things. I wouldn't have to necessarily go all the way back to the all uppercase machine, but I definitely do feel like there is a sort of like quick, easy access that you had before that it's maybe, I don't know, it's harder to find now. You have to sort of actively seek it out. And I think you might be right that a lot of people don't need it. The only problem is that if you've never seen it, you don't kind of know what it's like anymore.
Oh, good point. Okay. Yes, absolutely. Nice. Well said. Okay. Michael, you thought you were going to avoid the gaze of my spotlight of inquisition, but you were wrong.
Oh, I'm sweating already.
It can curve. It can get you even on your side of the planet. So, BASIC. We are now discussing the idea that BASIC does or does not exist in the real world. You open up a computer nowadays, it is a consumer device used for perhaps consuming media. And if you're doing creation, it's more creation like filmmaking, it's word processing, it's Instagramming the food you had last night, what have you. It's not necessarily programming for most, the vast majority of people who need computers. Does that obviate the need for BASIC? Are we missing BASIC? Should we have something like BASIC? Am I wrong? Is BASIC actually on modern computers and I'm just unaware of it? What say you, Michael?
Well, I think that all the kids out there, some of them in their 30s, who are starting to play Call of Duty 75, they don't know what BASIC is. They don't really care. And I don't really think they're missing out on much. If someone wants to get into the programming side of things, then yes, they can get all the introductory utilities and programs loaded onto their machine for them. That all starts off at the various techs and schools. But no, I don't think there's a need for a BASIC in ROM equivalent on today's machines. Things have changed. The computer is now an appliance. It's gone from being a tool. It's still used as a tool, but it's an appliance. So they're more interested in Facebook or other instant messaging or whatever that they're wanting to use to be hip and cool, and that us old fogies aren't going to be bothering them about. There's always going to be room for programmers, and I just don't see that the necessity of having a BASIC in ROM equivalent in today's machines.
It does make walking into the the Sears or the Kmart less interesting for the kids. They can't put in a little looping program that says, you know, Sears sucks or whatever.
This is true. There is something lost there, I'll admit. For me, I, for a long time, argued that removing BASIC hurt computers. It was a terrible thing. I was a champion of things like HyperCard on the Mac for a while, like things that would let somebody sit down at a computer, have an idea, and create a program, whatever definition of program one wants to use. But something where you're going to pour in text, essentially, you're going to pour in some form of code and get some form of executable result. And I thought that there was something fundamentally wrong with computers that didn't ship with those. I have become watered down in that opinion, and I've sort of learned to accept that I've learned to believe that most people want their computers to just be an appliance. They're happy with their computer being a gaming machine or a web machine or what have you, and they didn't feel the need to make their own movies when they had a VCR. They didn't feel the need to necessarily, if they're like me, cook just because you have a stove. That's what the telephone is for. It brings me food. So I think it's the case that we are very fortunate at the moment that there is a massive range of accessible development environments for every computer out there, even stretching the definition of computer. If there's a thing that can run code, there's a relatively easy and free way for you to make something run on it. And that doesn't necessarily ship with the computers anymore, but it was the case back in the day that if you were interested enough, you would seek out the books that would teach you to program, you would seek out the magazines, you would seek out the peripherals, you would seek out what you needed. If it's in your heart to make these things, you will find it. And I think today that there's Paul was saying earlier, there is Chipmunk BASIC. There's lots of other BASICs. There's lots of other ways to code. There's PHP, there's Perl, there's Python. There's so many ways to make things. If you want to make code on your phone, you can. If you want to program all the vintage stuff, that still exists as well. And so I was probably too curmudgeonly, too early, which isn't something I normally think about myself. But I think we probably haven't actually lost anything by making BASIC not be something that computers immediately launch into. And that opinion's been a long time coming for me. It is also the case, though, that I think I will go to my grave thinking that BASIC is one of the most important, most beautiful, most accessible, most wonderful computer languages ever, ever, ever. Like Paul, I often think in BASIC, even though I have now been coding in C for way longer than I ever coded in BASIC. But, you know, you never forget your first love. I think my first programs were in BASIC. I still love it. With all its slowness and all its sloppiness and all its limitations, there's something glorious about BASIC. So I adore it. I'm glad it was birthed 50 years ago. And I would think, I don't want to speak with you guys, but I would think we're all probably still fans of BASIC and think it did good stuff and continues to do so. Do you guys agree?
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was absolutely essential. It's interesting that when the two guys created it, Kemeny and Kurtz, I hope I'm pronouncing their names right, they wanted to make the time-sharing system more accessible. They wanted to make a system where people could actually sit down and program the computer without having to have a PhD. And I know that when the folks were coming up with some of the first microcomputers, that the thinking was, we've had these time-sharing systems with BASIC. Engineers want to do BASIC. People who just want to do simple stuff want to do BASIC, so let's put it on the microcomputers too. And having that is a lot of what was responsible for the microcomputers being as popular as they were. I mean, just look at the impact that Altair BASIC had with the Altair computer. If you watch the movie Pirates of Silicon Valley, you know, Bill Gates says, and it's fictionalized, but he says something, without the BASIC, it's just a box with blinking lights and switches. And I know that's a dramatization, but it's true, mm-hmm. right? Without something there, it was only uber geeks could have approached it. So, yeah, and you know, the interesting thing, BASIC's legacy is still around today. It's still running. It's just not running when you turn on a PC, but there's the BASIC stamp microcontroller that was incredibly popular in that realm. Also, the PIC-X, a microcontroller based on the PIC used for educational purposes, came up with over in the UK. PIC-X runs BASIC natively. You've got still visualbasic.net, which arguably is so far evolved from the BASIC that we're used to with line numbers and that it's almost a misnomer to call it BASIC. But it's still got that BASIC legacy, a lot of the same syntax you'll see there. So, yeah, I think BASIC was incredibly important.
Yeah, especially, as you said, BASIC in ROM. I think that, to me, is what made the microcomputer revolution. I've always sort of thought to myself, what would have happened with the microcomputer start in the late 70s, early 80s, if there hadn't been a programming language that was there when you turned the machine on? It was turned on, it was ready to go, you could do something. There were not the resources available, there was no internet. The ease of getting something onto a computer back then, I really think that BASIC and ROM was one of the successful parts of the microcomputer industry. Without it, I don't know what we would have ended up with.
Mm. I agree. I think the world would have been very, very different. The world of computing, anyway, would have been very different without BASIC and ROM on so many.
It would have still been an elitist activity. The uber geeks, as you say, would have still been doing things, but I think the masses would have missed out.
It would have come, so computers, if they didn't come with BASIC and ROM, they would have instead come with a lab coat and a sniffy attitude and timeshare blocking, and it would have been a very different time. So I agree. So now, BASIC has turned 50 or is about to turn 50, and that's exciting. And as we've discussed, turned the world on when it comes to the tiny computers. But some big iron is also turning 50. So we can turn our eye from the little computers we had at home to the big ones they would have more institutional. Yeah, that could be a word. The IBM System 360 also has turned 50. Now, I have almost no experience with the 360. I have never been a mainframe kind of guy, but perhaps you guys know a little more about this than me. Let's again go around the table. It's round for a reason, baby. So let's spin the camera over to Earl. Earl, what have you got to say for yourself when it comes to the IBM System 360?
My interaction with mainframes personally was just kind of tangential. When I worked for Hughes Aircraft, I didn't spend a whole lot of time with them. That said, in terms of the world of data processing, wow, how do you even begin to talk about the impact of the System 360 architecture? It's just, and I think you could find the descendants of that architecture in heavy use today with things like the IBM System Z. And Michael will probably have more to say about this, because don't you kind of work in that realm, Michael?
Yeah, I came from a mainframe background. It wasn't until the System 390s that I joined the mainframe world, and that was one of my first my first IT job was actually doing application programming in Ramus, a 3.5 GL language. They'd like to call it a fourth generation language, but I didn't think it was quite there. So System 390, that was one of the successors to the 360, which we're, you know, saying is turning 50 and celebrating that fact. But and the last mainframe I programmed on would have been about 5 years ago, the big Z series boxes from IBM, running ZOS. I think we were using 1.4 back then, so things have moved on a bit, but it may have been the BASIC in ROM on the Apple II that got me into programming, but it was the mainframe that really got me serious into utility development and application development. Again, sort of to utilize the resources that were available, and in this case, keeping CPU usage down. Everything was measured in clicks, and times and resources. So just as we had to be carefully managing everything on the 8-bit micros, we still had to do similar back in the early 80s, mid-80s on the mainframe. So I've always programmed with an economical style. I try to get as much bang for my buck as I'm programming.
What about you, Paul? Anything to say for yourself when it comes to the IBM System 360?
Well, I have to say that I had almost no experience with anything of the sort. Although one of the things was, as I was reading some of the discussions about it turning 50 and things, one of the things that's impressive is that basically the System Zs now are Z or whatever. IBM's doesn't matter. Okay, but but they're still compatible. The backwards compatibility was a big concern, you know, because these are things running big, critical, you know, computationally expensive things. You don't want to rewrite them, and so throughout the development, including to now, you can still run things that you ran on the IBM System 360, which is amazing. I guess, yeah, I think we'll probably talk about it shortly, but the only real experience I've had with this stuff was attempting to run it under emulation. So there's a Hercules emulator, which I have done a little bit with. I think maybe Earl has done a little more.
For me, my only real mainframe experience was never hands-on with them. At school, there was a few occasions where we would fill out punch cards or the equivalent, and they'd be sent off somewhere, and we would get our results later. So I would be interacting from a distance with timeshare systems, with big mainframes, but I was never allowed to walk up. I was never a punch card feeder myself. I was just a punch card filler outer. The big thing that I had never realized with the System 360, and only really realized this week in reading about it because of the anniversary, was there's when you come first and when you come early, you can sometimes define things and you set standards. And standards that are set that are, in a sense, so ubiquitous that we forget that it's a choice that got made. And the idea that a byte is 8 bits is something that I just always took for granted. In the same way that once you get to 9, you have a placeholder and you have 1 and 0. Just thinking in terms of base 10 is just something I do, just the way the world is. I can work in other mathematical bases. Like I can do things in binary, I can do things in hex, but I think of, I got 10 figures and I just, so there's certain things that you just think of as kind of fundamental. And I've always thought a bit is a 1 or a 0. It's two things. A byte is 8 bits. I think of how big a kilobyte is, a megabyte. Like all these things are based on the idea of an 8-bit byte. But it's the System 360 that introduced that. There was no 8-bit byte before the System 360. There was a lot of, according to Wikipedia, pressure to make it 4 and 6. I read online that a lot of people wanted the byte to be 4 and 6. I think of the byte four bits as being a nibble. And I think of that as just a fundamental mathematical concept, like the byte. What is a byte? A byte is 8 bits. It is simply that's the way it is. And I never really realized that, of course, somebody had to make that call, and it was made with the System 360. And that's something that has resonated in every computer forever and ever since that date. And to me, like, that was a real mind-blowing thing to sort of come to that realization.
Yeah, they did set a lot of standards. I'm amazed. I didn't know up until this birthday came up what Paul was talking about with the backwards compatibility. We think that it's really impressive that you could take a program that was created for a PC, say in 1981, and maybe be able to run that on a modern machine, although with 64-bit OSs, it'll probably choke these days. It did run up until a few years ago, but they said, this is on the Wikipedia page regarding the System Z or System Z. In effect, current systems are the direct lineal descendants of System 360 announced in 1964. And the System 370 from the 1970s, many applications written for these systems can still run unmodified on the newest System Z over four decades later.
Talk about no progress. No, I'm kidding. it is pretty remarkable.
Talk about forward thinking.
Boy, is that, and you know, working in the financial and the healthcare sectors, I can tell you the two interesting things about the mainframe culture to me. One is that the box sitting in the data center behind the closed doors with not necessarily with lab coats now, but that same sort of environment persists, that you've got the keepers of the primordial key, you know, these folks who are like, you know, they're the defenders of the mainframe, and they must do a darn good job, because in those sectors that I worked in, the things were absolutely positively bulletproof. Like you never heard the mainframe's down. You would hear the file servers are down or the printer's down or something like that.
Oh, it's just the mainframe people pointing fingers.
Yeah, maybe. But you'd never hear that the mainframe was down. It is just solid as a rock. And I think after 50 years, maybe you get some of that.
Yeah, very exciting.
Yeah, my favorite part of the mainframe was when I was programming back in late 80s. I'd moved to Sydney. And we got an alert from the operators that the mainframe was going down because the plumber hadn't come on site. There was a leak in the chiller plant, and they were concerned that they weren't getting enough cold water into the system to keep the mainframe running.
And the dinosaurs would get out.
Oh. it was just a laugh that here we are. Working away, large financial institution, and they're easing back on the mainframe because there's a leak in the chiller plant and the plumber's late coming on site.
Well, very nice. So two big birthdays. Happy birthday to both the System 360 and, of course, to BASIC. We will have various links and stuff of everything that we just mentioned that you can look up.
I think Paul was going to mention emulation, though.
Oh, emulate. Let's emulate Paul. Can one really truly emulate Paul?
I'm not up to it.
It wasn't OS 360 that I tried to use, but I did try to use Hercules. And Hercules, we have a couple of links in the show notes about how you can install the OS 360 on Hercules, which is a I'm not actually sure. It's a emulator for this class of hardware.
Yeah, even up to the Z series, you can't get the latest ZOS, but the Linux that can run on the Z series machines, you can install that onto some versions of Hercules. So if you don't have room in your garage for a real mainframe, well, put one on your computer.
There's a sort of a long story about this, but my mother worked with some of these, and I'm not sure exactly what the exact system was, but she worked with MVS primarily, and various things that went along with this, things that had names like CICS and RACF and things that I, you know, like these acronyms that I remember hearing in my youth. But so there was a I think this was a there was a annual conference called Share, which was a IBM IBM people would get together and, you know, exchange information about whatever was happening now. And there, one of the things that happened sort of periodically was there was like a sing along, and people, you know, and the people made sort of you know, modified humorous IBM based lyrics to popular songs. And there was one. The one that stuck in my head was "We all live in a virtual machine," and so I wanted to find the lyrics to that, and wound up sort of digging around, finding that there is somewhere a tape, you know, an archive tape that has the Share songbook on it, and I couldn't read the format, and so I actually, you know, sort of loaded up Hercules and tried to install MVS so that I could mount this tape. And it was actually a really interesting experience, and it's running such a machine is quite, it's quite something. Also, I was astounded at the output that it, you know, when you start the thing up, several forests go down because it spits out so much output. If it actually went to paper, and I'm sure it often did, it's just insane. But and eventually I did, I think I did actually get this mounted, this tape, and you know, managed to decode the file, and it, you know, actually getting the lyrics was not all that, you know, that wasn't the main point. After I got started, it was actually sort of fun just to try to see if I could get all the subsystems going and things. Very so nice. It's worth trying.
And a friend of mine who was one of the lab-coded individuals back in the day, I had found one of the turnkey installations of Hercules that you could run off a CD. So I brought it into work, and we booted up on it, and she spent a huge amount of time playing with it. And you just see the glow. It was like, oh my gosh, this brings back such memories of back in the day when yeah, you had all those acronyms. So, but I think that the RACF security system is still in use in some places today, although I think they're, what's that?
Yeah, RACF and both the ACF2 have most recently been working with some of our clients, and both those security systems are still in place. Very, very big installations.
Mm-hmm.
So, I just can't get over the fact that when we set up a Hercules server, we actually snuck onto a couple other people's 3270 emulators on their PCs and changed the source IP address on it to go to our Hercules emulated mainframe rather than the proper one. So the people going, hey, what's wrong with ZOS? This is MVS. What's going on? So that was the best part about it, because you interface to it just like it was another mainframe. You put in the IP address port, set up all the security on it, and yes, and suddenly they were wondering where did their typical sign-on screen go.
Nice.
Geek humor.
Geek humor. Well, that's what we're here for. In fact, Michael, we are going to stay with you as we dive out of the birthday celebrations and into the items of interest. And I believe our first topic here is fun with 3D printers. Now, when you say 3D printers, I think fun is implied. I think that's redundant. But what have you got to say for fun with 3D printers?
Well, when 3D printers first started coming onto the scene, I suppose it was the boring Michael that first thought about, I can make customized fixings and bits and pieces, repairs for computers, bits around the house. And it never dawned on me that I could actually use it to make trinkets and toys and fun things. So just recently, a few objects d'art have flown past me on Google Plus and Facebook and others. And so we've got Mario Androletti with a Sinclair ZX80, which he's done a 3D printing. So
it's adorable. It's tiny and lovely. I just absolutely love it.
Yep. Apparently you can make a very large penny as well.
Penny for scale. Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah. I just love what he has done. Yeah.
Well, actually, that's a good point. Did he actually 3D print the oversized Penny to make the ZX80 look small?
Could be. He could be sneaky that way.
Yeah, that's a lot of spools going into that printer. In the Apple II world, Charles Mangan has produced a Disk II SD card reader. So there's in the shape of the ye olde Disk II drive. You just slide in your SD card, USB socket on the other end into your modern day computer, and you too can have a Disk II. And he's also had previously created an iPod Nano dock in the shape of a classic Toaster Mac, so that you just slide your 6th-gen iPod Nano into the 3D printed dock, and the Nano actually became the screen of a little miniature Macintosh.
Fantastic.
I just love what some of these people are doing. So I've got a call out here to our listeners. What have you done with your 3D printers? Are you being like Boring Michael and making customized disc mounts to or card mounts to for your retro machines, or are you using it to custom print a replacement piece? Plastic brakes. Are you replacing anything in your current machines with a customized 3D printed element, or are you just playing with it and making cute little things that are sort of like sitting around on top of your computer monitor? Actually, you can't do that anymore. It's a bit hard to sit things on top of your monitors with these LCD things these days.
True, unless they're really tiny.
Yeah. So, I just thought that it's just marvelous. As I said, trinkets and toys as well as useful. So, 1,001 uses for the 3D printer. I'm just going to have to go and get one, I think.
Me too. And I would love to hear if our listeners have any experience with it, if they've done anything cool, what have you. We could then promote it. I am still so excited about that technology.
Yeah, it really does seem like there are quite a number of parts that one could create for repairs. That one of the things I had been thinking about was the old AppleCat modem. There were some ads for the AppleCat modem. It was a pretty popular modem with the Apple II. But one of the things that was kind of hilarious about it was you could get these little things that would stick out the vents in the side, and you could hang the phone on it. And so if you ever see a picture of this, I think if you just Google search Novation AppleCat, this is one of the first pictures that shows up, because it's just so it's fairly comical looking, but I would love to be able to recreate that. But I don't have the little things, to hang it on. And that's one of the, if I were to get a 3D printer, that's one of the first things I think I would try to do.
Or if you have trouble with your computers yellowing, as lots of old computers do, especially the Apple computers, just make a new case.
Right. Or print opaque glasses.
Ooh, nice.
Then you can't just, then you just can't see it.
Right, exactly. Just polarize that out. You don't have a problem with yellow. Remove yellow from your life completely. Very nice. So next up, I guess, is me. Now, when back in the day, I believe, in fact, it was a Tuesday, when people would discuss OS 9, I would be ambivalent. I would be a man of two minds. I would think the Macintosh OS 9 that got me through many, many years of use. I was never necessarily a huge fan. Those were some of the darker days for the Apple. But then there was the other OS 9, which was the, and I hate to say it, Unix-like operating system. And I know big fans of OS 9 would say, whatever. Unix was like the OS, was the wimpy, less functional version of OS 9. But that's an argument for another podcast. But I've always thought of OS 9 as being something that, it's sort of high-end. It runs on the 6809 microprocessor. I was completely unaware that there was at one point, and now is, a brand new version of an operating system called Nitros 9. You can see the OS 9 part of that. And it is essentially OS 9 for the Tandy Coco, and also for the equivalent computer, the Dragon. So this was completely news to me, and I guess according to the announcement that it's been 6 years or so since there was any movement, any updates on this operating system. But luckily, just very recently, about a week or so ago, a new version 3.3.0, has been released. So if you are a fan of the Tandy Coco, and you should be because it's a pretty swell computer, or the Dragon computer, and you're looking for an alternative operating system, then this might be something that is pretty sweet and cool to check out. I haven't actually checked it out myself, not having a Coco handy, but I think this is fantastic that this exists, and I'm surprised that it's been ported to work on the different chip and that works on these computers at all. So pretty cool, I think. Have any of you guys got any experience with either Nitros 9 or OS 9?
No,
and that would be crickets.
Yep. Not for the Coco. My only OS 9 I know of or have used was for the Mac and Slosh.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the Coco is something that I would like to get, you know, sort of involved in a little bit more. I have a couple of project machines waiting for me to get to them. So not yet. I haven't yet, but it's good to know about this for when that time comes.
I remember when OS 8 was the Macintosh operating system, there were lots of people would talk about how, well, if they come out with OS 9, what will they call it? Because they clearly can't call it OS 9. That has existed, you know, since the early 80s. I mean, yes, for years, Apple certainly just can't use somebody else's trademark. Oh, how they did not understand the way Steve Jobs works. He said, OS 9, fine, we're calling it OS 9. And thus, of course, a lawsuit did ensue. Presumably it got settled. I don't remember whatever happened with that lawsuit, but I do remember that there was one and that the current owners of OS 9 went and sued Apple and said, you can't use our trademark. And Apple said, but we are Apple. We do what we want. And that was setting a trend that would continue with other names in the future.
Interesting. I never knew about that. I'm going to go take a look at that and read up on that.
Yep.
Never knew that lawsuit happened.
Let's see. The internet says... Fascinating. Yes, Macroware at the time. Macroware sued Apple that year for trademark infringement. Oh, and but a judge ruled... This is something I didn't know. A judge ruled that there wouldn't be confusion between the two operating systems, so that because Macintosh users were particularly unaware of Microware. Poor Microware.
Other computers on Earth exist.
Yeah, they said just the users of Macintosh would not even know what OS 9 was. Wow, that's harsh, dude. So I guess that's what happened with that.
Non-infringement by ignorance.
Oh, that's a shame.
And not true in your case, right?
I was totally aware of OS 9. In fact, I remember lots of people discussing, it was a thing, saying, well, they're not going to be able to call the next operating system OS 9. Because that's already an operating system. It's not like it exists as a different product. It exists as a long-standing computer operating system with that trademark from 1979. Goofed. So, yeah.
There was a goof. They should reopen the case right now.
I agree. It's time to reopen that case. And the iPhone trademark lawsuit as well. So, what can you do? So, anyway, I'm quite excited that there is a new operating system or a re-release, an update of an operating system for the Tandy Coco, a computer that still has a warm and fuzzy place in my heart. So, next up, I guess we are going
Just before you go on that, maybe they should have called it OS 10.
But then they'd have to sue themselves from the future.
No, but see, their previous version was 9. This is just the sequential numbering, and let's see what Apple does.
Absolutely, you know, that's not a bad idea. And you know, the fact they're going to use Roman numerals, you know, it's just a thing. Ah, lawsuits everywhere. What if they can then argue no one's heard of Apple's? So what? Who? What is this operating system you have? Our users wouldn't have heard of it.
No, a Windows user wouldn't be confused by that.
No, not at all. So, Earl, I think you're next going to grab something that Steve, who unfortunately couldn't be on the show with us this week, had chimed up a bit. So I don't know if you had a chance to watch these, but looks like British Pathé newsreels have popped onto YouTube.
That is correct, and I thank Steve for putting this on there. And we miss you, Dr. Steve. I think actually I heard an internet rumor that Dr. Steve doesn't actually exist, that he's just a figment of our imagination. But I can tell you he's really out there, and he wants to join us. He's going to be on the show pretty soon. In the meantime, he submitted some really exciting news about this. How did you pronounce it, Carrington? Do you think it's British Pathé?
Pathé.
Is that the Pathé? And 85,000 clips have made their way onto YouTube from this apparently famous archive. many interesting things. This doesn't just involve computing. In fact, not even primarily. It's all kinds of historic film. And I've really been getting into this lately. I love looking at these films from the 50s and 60s and 70s. It's just so cool and often very historically interesting. But if you go to the YouTube site, which we'll have a link to, you can, in the little search bar there, search for computer or for other things like that. And it brings up quite a few things. And if you're specifically interested in vintage computing, you can see some computers running in the 60s and 70s doing things like helping out on farms or helping out in government type things. And just looking at the old data centers and that and the teletypes, it's really a lot of fun. So go check it out. And if you're a vintage-minded person, then maybe you'd be interested in some of the other things that they have on there, because I found some of it really intriguing. Did I use intriguing too much? Interesting, fascinating, lovely, wonderful.
It is all of those things. Yeah.
That's so intriguing.
And black and white.
There's a little bit of an overview, and there's an article in Time, which is, I think, maybe what sort of triggered the... That was one of the links. We'll have that in there. But that actually has categorized a few things that are specifically computer related.
I love the electronic horse racing one. Mm-hmm. During an outbreak of hoof and mouth disease, horse racing fans settled for a computerized simulation, and there they are. They're sitting over the chart, and that one. There's all of these. I'm just going to have to watch them again. They are such a laugh. I love these old newsreel articles.
It's a long lost art. Yeah. The comment at the end, I thought was, so this is Harry McCracken who wrote this, and he points out that unless British Pathé sweetened its soundtracks, computers used to be noisy. And that's probably quite true.
And they did. they were very, very noisy. And gosh, there was something else I was going to say on that. But, you know, I'm getting old and I forgot.
we'll make a newsreel around you. Next up.
Oh, it was about newsreels. Is the fact that when you listen to these things, one of the things I noticed was the resonance of the voice of the announcers. I don't know how we've lost this, but we don't have people with those kind of voices anymore. Do you guys know what I mean?
Sure, totally.
The people would have these extremely clear and resonant voices. And it's like, wow, that just feels so good to hear that. Can you, like, come into the future and do some news today? Because now it's just, it's not the same.
It's because you're in America, dude. If you come to Canada, listen to the CBC, or more so in the BBC, the continuity announcers are famed for their enunciation, their clarity, their impact.
Their what?
Which is why I am a podcaster rather than a BBC.
I'm sure the BBC used to run classes for their announcers.
I suspect they still do. Yes, there is a very particular way to speak if you want to be a BBC continuity announcer, it seems.
And in fact, actually, that is the case. I was I would sort of like to learn that accent, but there is something called the transatlantic accent or the mid-Atlantic accent that you were taught. You know, so the way this newsreel speak is, it's an actual taught thing, like the BBC as well.
And you can only learn it in mid-Atlantic as well. You have to be on a Zeppelin taking classes to learn to speak over the sound of the propellers.
I will train in that at some point. Maybe perhaps by the next podcast, I will be able to speak it.
You've got 2 weeks. Go.
Okay. Excellent.
Very nice. So we will have links to the Time article discussing that. We also have links to the British Pathé site itself, which is just britishpathé.com. And if you head over there, you can see tons and tons and tons of clips, not just on science and technology, but also the old entertainment things, the sports things, what have you. Of course, Pathé News was around in, well, British Pathé from like 1910 to I think 50s or 60s at least, maybe 70s, and almost as long in the US. So there is quite a large collection of newsreels to while away a Sunday afternoon with. It's a wonderful way. Love the stuff that's collected there. So Paul, you are up next, and I hope since the last article that we discussed, your diction and your enunciation has improved. You are taking the classes between speeches. I hope we will hear the difference. But you are going to talk about something that we've mentioned on previous shows, couple times as something that would be coming up in the future, and remarkably, it's finally here. The big dig looking for Atari cartridges has actually started. Very exciting. So tell us a bit about that.
Well, so the what has basically happened, just I think this was even just yesterday, so they went to, what is the name of this place, Alamogordo, New Mexico, where rumor had it, perhaps more than rumor, that at the time of the video game crash, when Atari had made twice as many ET cartridges as there were consoles and then couldn't sell them, they took them to a dump site and buried them. And so I think Microsoft, and I think this has something to do with the Xbox or something like that. There's some segment of Microsoft that has funded a documentary. The producers of the documentary got permission to go dig. They located where this spot was, and actually reading about it, it's a small spot. I think it was 10 by 40 feet or something like that in a 300-acre landfill. But they located where it was by interviewing people who drove trucks at the time. And so yesterday was the day when everybody converged and they got the big, the big earth movers in and dug down. And, it turned out, in fact, that they did find it. I suspect that they said, as I was reading some of the other things about it, a little bit earlier they had gone in and dug some test wells and things just to make sure. So I think it may have the actual large dig was yesterday, but I think they may have already known they were gonna get it. But they went down. They found a bunch of the Atari layer underneath the 1983 tax returns, They did find some smashed up but basically intact ET cartridges and boxes and centipedes and it's a bunch of stuff has actually come out. A lot of people, I think, didn't really think it was going to be they thought it would be sort of Al Capone's vault esque, but this did actually yield something.
Well, there's always been that discussion about is it just a myth that Atari dumped a bunch of cartridges, a million cartridges? So we'll see what kind of quantity of stuff is found.
Yeah. And I wonder if it occurs to me, ET is sort of famous for this. I'm not sure if the blame entirely lies with it, but it's sort of famous as being the one that Atari put way too much money in, rushed out way too quickly. And then couldn't sell nearly the amount that they had and was very damaging to the company, but maybe the entire industry, but I guess the thing is, you can find them. I see them on eBay occasionally, and I think, this is a piece of history, even though everybody says it's a terrible game. But now I'm wondering if there's going to be a new market for dirty, kind of slightly crushed ET cartridges that were underground.
Well, the thing is, from what I've read,
to be underground.
Yeah, well, that's it. And from what I've read, oddly, and I guess because one of the big issues with getting approval to do this dig was people that run landfills don't want items from landfills that are now technically considered toxic items to go back into general circulation, because gosh knows what pathogens they're bringing with them. And so they don't like things being removed. So one of the big debates, one of the big points of discussion was, they dig this up, are they allowed to take stuff, or allowed to take how much of it or what have you? And as far as I can tell from reading, they're allowed to remove 100 items. So if they find cartridges, even if they find a million, they can take 100 cartridges, or maybe 50 cartridges and 50 manuals or what have you. So there shouldn't be a big flood on the market of legitimate landfill items, but it could be the case that, those of us with ET cartridges are going to splash them in mud and crack them and try to sell them for 10 times as much on eBay. But we will see if those of us who would do such a thing will actually do it.
Yeah.
I'll go get my muddy boots right now.
You would think at the collector prices that some of the stuff from this dig might command that you would need a little bit more documentation of provenance than that.
And will it be? I guess it would be a thing. I guess if you want the cartridge just to have it rather than play it, maybe you would want one of the supposedly mythical, famous, dumped in the landfill versions. And yet it still is literally a piece of landfill trash.
Right.
Wow. Now, if I was going to dig up landfill trash, I think I'd go looking for the leases myself. But that
would make it. There's a show topic for another show. Landfill right. Item that you would want.
This did, of course, bring up, you know, like people saw this and saw success, and then, you know, and then many people brought up the topic of, well, you know, Apple also dumped about like 3,000 Lisas in a landfill. You know, couldn't we go find those? Although the consensus, I think, on that is that, so I don't think Atari, I think Atari just dumped these. Apple actually, you know, crushed the Lisas on film to prove to the tax people that they should get a tax refund.
So if you can find those, they'd be really worth a lot of money.
They would be in very small pieces under probably quite a lot of garbage.
The ultimate geek mulch for the garden.
Right.
It's so, underneath those shrubs are my crushed Lisas, and then over there are my TRS-80s. It makes
widgets
storage
are very
so much
good
easier.
For tomatoes.
And you'd have those little signs that go in the garden that show the flowers, but they'd be little signs showing the actual PC that's been...
And what it looks like before it got crushed. Yeah. And storage is so much easier, too.
Yes, I guess when it's just bulk, when you're just getting it by the gram.
Yeah, a bag of Lisa over there, and... and that nice. Big pile of PC stuff I can't do anything with.
Nice. So very, very interesting stuff, though, there, Paul. So we'll have links in the show notes to a couple of... articles discussing the big Atari dig in Alamogordo, which Alamogordo is fun to say, so that's another reason to bring this up. So, Michael, we turn to you next. And this was something that I saw online as well and was quite surprised to read about. So something with Warhol items on floppy disk?
That's right. Someone basically found that there was a pile of Atari floppy disks that Andy Warhol had used, and they thought they'd just go have a look. So they knew he'd done some work in the past, and they didn't know if anything would exist on these disks. They didn't know what would be the best way of actually looking at the disks, as they say, trapped for nearly 30 years on Amiga floppy disks and stored in the archive collection of the Andy Warhol Museum. So they knew they were his. He might have used them for notes or something. So they got together with the computer users. And what I found most interesting is that they were using the CryoFlux interface to look at what's on these disks. So rather than risk the disks with a older machine trying to open them up and see what they were on them, we'll have a link to a 15-page PDF which details the process that they use to examine the disks and to retrieve the information off them. They basically image the disks and then worked with the disk images. So, I think it's a great example of computer archaeology or info archaeology. So it's a great read that along with the CMU Computer Club that they went in not knowing what they were going to find, and but they found an excellent trove of Andy Warhol creations on those discs using image editing software from back 30 years ago. And, it's interesting. I think it's about as good as some of his real art, but I've never been an Andy Warhol fan myself, but I think it's a great piece of forensic computer work. Forensic retro computing. It's excellent.
Yeah, maybe one of the most... I'm not a huge Warhol art fan myself either, but this may be one of the most exciting things since the Jordan Mechner stuff that they found. Because it's... I agree. It's a really interesting case of digital archaeology.
And it's interesting in that, like, with art, you're dealing often with the most valuable version is the original. It's the hands-on one by the artist, and then you've got the prints, you've got the Jai Cleese, you've got the essentially authorized knockoffs of the original, but the first painting is the most valuable. So here we're dealing with something which the digital version is the first version. So I wonder how that affects... because it's a Warhol. This is not just like, you know, Bobby's great. It might look like Bobby's great 10 art, but it's not. And so I'm joining you on the not big fan of Warhol. And I don't know art, but I know what I boot. So I don't know. Like, is it that the floppy disk itself becomes the most valuable version that gets hung up on the wall? Like, I don't know. It's,
I don't know that there will be a huge, I think it's just a discovery that's important in its own right. I don't know that it'll create a lot of wealth. I could be wrong. I think it'll just be digital information that is now recovered and is noteworthy due to who created it.
Yeah, one of the things I think is important about it is that it's, it brings to the general media, to people's attention, that there could be interesting stuff just sitting on those floppy disks. I've just seen so many eBay auctions where someone just says, here's 100, 500 floppy disks. I don't know what's on them. I'm just selling them. Please take them.
So you're going to say we're going to have like an antique roadshow, but for vintage computers?
Yeah. It could be. So, you know, okay, so I doubt I'm going to find any Warhol art or any other Australian artist's work sitting on the floppy disks in the my back storage area. Now, the thing is, though, is that I'm sure I've got documents in there, things I've written, notes that I've forgotten about. And really, I should get in and basically do the same thing. And now, kids who have inherited their mothers and fathers' computers and box of stuff from the shed out the back, you know, maybe they should go for a bit of a dig in there and just see what's on there. There could be something interesting, just as important from a family perspective, nowhere near as, I suppose, as newsworthy, in quotes, as finding Warhol art for the first time. But I think, you know, people should make an effort to find out what's on those old floppy disks that are sitting around suffering from potential bit rot. Get in, have a look. You never know what you're going to find.
Especially because as much as it takes effort and it's difficult to do that now, it's only getting more difficult because this is all on media that's going to die. It's not like you can have a painting in your attic for 500 years. You didn't realize, oh my goodness, that this stuff doesn't list. You have a floppy disk in your attic for 500 years. You now just have a chunk of plastic. You no longer have data. So
that's right.
There
it can't
is a
be sent to a restorer.
Yeah.
It can't be restored. It can only be retrieved, and you can only get what's there or what's left.
Or what's left, or because this is all crumbling away in a way that traditional media isn't, especially older magnetic media, things like floppy disks. You know, even modern stuff, you know, CDs are supposedly lasting longer, but you deal with these old floppies, and my goodness, it's still the case that I'll open up, because I love to open up things, fresh new boxes of floppies. So you take the shrink wrap off 10 new 5 1/4 inch floppy disks from back in the day, and there'll be a couple of them that fail already. They've never been written to, and they're failing. So time is ticking on these things. So yes, if you have a box of floppies in the attic, you owe it to your grandfather to save that data. Copy that floppy. Ignore all the old things. Everything they told you before was wrong. Copy all the floppies.
Did I hear you right? Did I hear you saying that you're gonna make a copy of a game without paying? Come on, guys. I thought you knew better. Don't copy that floppy.
Wait a minute. Who the heck are you anyway?
Yeah, and what are you doing on our computer?
I'm your MC, Double Death, DP, that's the disc protector. For you and the posse, that's the artist, writers, designers, and programmers. That work up the images for games and grammar. That lets you learn, but also play the games you came here for today. Now I know you love the games, and that's alright to do, because the posse who makes them, they love them too. But if you start stealing, there's no more they can do.
But I just wanted to make one copy.
You say, I'll just make a copy for me and a friend. Then he'll make one and she'll make one, and where will it end? One leads to another, then 10, then more. And no one buys any discs from the store. So no one gets paid and they can't make more. The posse breaks up and then closes the store. Don't copy that floppy. So let me break this down for you. Don't. No common San Diego, no more Oregon Trail. Tetris and the others, they're all gonna fail. Not because we want it, but because you're just taking it. Disrespecting all the folks who are making it. The more you take, the less there will be. The disc becomes fewer, the games fall away. The screen starts to shrink and then it will fade. Programs fall through a black hole in space. The computer world becomes bleak and stark. Loses its life and the screen goes to dark.
Welcome to the end of the computer age.
It's a blog entry from 3 years ago, but maybe we could still put in the notes by Jason Scott, titled Floppy Disks, It's Too Late.
Oh.
It's from July 2011. He said, someone has to break it to you, and that person is me. It's over. You waited too long. You procrastinated or made excuses or otherwise didn't think about it or care. You didn't do anything, and it's too late now.
Oh. Yeah. Jason, breaking my heart.
You know,
I'm not going to bother.
As you know, reluctant as Jason is to be, you know, blunt, I find this that I'm kidding. By the way, the blog article is really good, so we should post this because it tries to get people to take action now. It's like grabbing somebody and shaking them by the shoulders and going, copy it now before it's too late. When I read this, I dug into the closet and started imaging my 5 1/4 discs. Mm. I was like, oh, he's right.
But in case you worry about that, I mean, it should ideally, if you've been listening to us say, well, it's too late, and that and something in your stomach goes, oh, no. Luckily, it's often not too late yet, and archive.org, the team there over at archiveteam.org, there's a link at the bottom of the article that Earl was just talking about, over to a great wiki they have about rescuing floppy disks. Gives ideas about the medium, what's involved, what tools exist currently, what are best tools to use on different operating systems for different sorts of floppies, what are the methods you can use, and all of that. So there's a great wiki. If you've got floppy disks and you think they're dead or you think they're failing or you don't know what's on them or you don't know what to do, there's one handy page you can go to that will lead you to all the info you need. So we will link to that in the show notes as well.
Yeah. Actually, one thing I want to put in there as well, in this as well, is that I think the reason I'm here on this podcast is that...
Comic relief.
Well,
and Vikings.
And that blog entry. Because that was essentially... I read that entry and I thought, I have a box of discs. I really have to get something so that I can quickly copy them. And so I bought a 2GS and then, fell down the very steep, slippery slope.
That you're still falling
nice.
Down.
So but, that blog and, entry but touched actually, a number of us.
Yeah, and, cool. and welcome to the bottom of the slippery slope.
Yeah. I'm only halfway.
There is no bottom. And it's funny, too, because I remember reading that blog entry as well. And even that first paragraph, I was like, oh, God, it's hard to even read this. I have procrastinated too much. I am part of the problem. So it really resonated with me as well.
The good thing is that I don't think it's actually true, or at least it. I've had very good success, actually, with a lot of the 5 1/4 inch floppies. I haven't tried much with 3 1/2 inch floppies, and I understand that they are much they're failing at a much higher rate, but it will be too late soon. Even so, still try now.
But the nice thing is, floppy disks, as much as they had a bunch of data on them back in the day, they've got like nothing compared to modern storage. It's a wisp of a hint of data. It's like nothing. You take all the floppies that you've ever owned in your entire lifetime, and they will fit in a folder on a small corner of your smallest current hard drive. It's like nothing at all. So the nice thing is you can recover all this data, and it's not even remotely a burden to keep it and to back it up. And just like once I recovered a bunch of floppy disks, I then just made a folder. I put every stuff, all the things in there. I made copies of the data. I made disk images of the disks. And it's very easy to just incorporate that into your normal backup routine and have them just move from hard drive to hard drive with you through your life, and you'll never lose them again and have multiple copies.
Once it's digitized, you can take it anywhere. It's just that getting off your backside and getting that first step of making the disk image, getting the data, and then once you've done it, you can, as you said, you integrate it into your existing backup process, of which everyone has a backup process, don't you?
Don't you?
Hmm. Speaking to hard drives, I'm now finding that in the process of moving house, I've found a set of 120 gigabyte hard drives that I'd been using for video editing. And there were interesting bits and pieces on those discs that didn't get incorporated into the DVD that I had been making at the time. So, yeah, even those I'm now sort of transferring or copying them over to a RAID device so that I've still got the original 120 gig drive. I'll just box it and store it, but I'm just now I can find a slightly larger little envelope in the corner of a hard drive somewhere to include those bits and pieces. You know, with terabytes of media available these days, you can hide in a couple of hundred gigabytes here and there.
Yeah, I now have multiple layers of it. I've got things that I recovered, put onto hard drives, and those hard drives got imaged, and then the images just on later hard drives. So you can kind of go down a rabbit hole. My bigger issue has been with file formats. So I recover a bunch of word processing things, but they're in ClarisWorks One format, and like nothing even wants to acknowledge that it exists as a format. And so it's been more my occasional, like I went through periods in my life where I was all about non-proprietary or at least relatively open formats or saving copies, one copy in ClarisWorks, one copy is an RTF or something like that. And then I would go through periods where that seemed like a hassle. Why should I bother? And now that comes back and bites me because I'll look at a file and go, is this an AppleWorks? What is it? It's a bunch of binary data with no extension on it. I don't know what this thing is.
There's lots of different ways of doing that. One of the ones that got my interest was WordPerfect 5.1 being run on a SheepSaver Mac OS 8 emulation so that WordPerfect can be run on there so that they can open up the WordPerfect files and either work with them directly or then save them into other more common proprietary formats or to an open format. So it's an interesting rabbit hole that you can fall into. Yes, I've now gone and recovered this file. Now what do I do with it?
Yeah.
There's one more thing that I wanted to sort of put in here, which is that this works fairly well if you... You know, if you're just copying, if you just made sort of like a full disk of your documents and you just saved it and whatever. But one problem is that things were so protected back then that certainly commercial disks, it's not simple to just make an archive of them, because if it was simple, then people would copy them back in the day. So that's one of the things that these devices like the CryoFlux or the Disk Ferret are good for is they actually... At least for the moment, they can take a low-level flux image of the disk, which of course does take actually a larger corner of your hard drive. But then you can analyze it later. So if at this point we can't deal with that format, at least you can get all the magnetic information off.
Well, plus, there's a serious coolness to that.
Yeah,
that's what I've been doing with some of my disks, which if I can't just load them in through CryoFlux and save them as a DMG. I then just do the save the re-image, save the stream file for later work. So that, as you said, the information is there. If they've done a track shift or half tracks, quarter tracks, or whatever encryption that they were using, then later on maybe I can work on those images directly. But the other thing with the CryoFlux, they are progressively adding write support for various output media. So hopefully those stream images which I've got, I can actually write back to original media and crack them with a copy of Locksmith or whatever, or even have a Locksmith program that will work with the stream image. The computer power is there. I just have to find the inclination.
Mm-hmm. See, now this is it's impossible to stop talking about this.
Well, but I was just saying this is basically like we're a bonus host topic in the middle of this. Yeah. In fact, I suspect it's something we'll return to because I also can think of 10 more things that I would like to say on this topic.
Okay, so how about next time we talk about disk imaging and streams and things?
I think that sounds like a good idea. I suspect our audience will like that as well. If you're listening, you got this far in and you're intrigued, what is this cryoflux we are talking about? And these backup methods, recovery methods, all of that. There's going to be a ton, I'm sure, that we all can contribute to that. I'd love to hear listeners' thoughts as well. And then maybe that will end up being our host topic for next show. For now, though, because we are well past the 1 hour mark, I think we should dive forward. We have one more little item of news or an item of interest to talk about, and which kind of relates earlier to the British Pathé newsreel clips that were on YouTube. Very similar to that are the videos of the U.S. National Archives. Those have been making their way over to YouTube as well. And I'm going to single out one in particular to sort of wet your whistle, dear listener. If you watch this, you find it interesting, then all the National Archives are online for you to dive in, and you will lose many, many hours watching. So this is a great documentary called Right on the Button. It is an IRS video, the tax people in the U.S., that's scary tax people, and it's a video essentially introducing computers and what they can do with them to the general public and making them a little less scary. And it's quite long. I think it's 90 minutes or something, but it's fascinating. And if you want to look at old iron and old concepts and just, it was a wonderful rabbit hole. I watched it and I just absolutely adored it. Earl, I think you watched it as well. Is that correct?
I did, and I had the same reaction to it. I think just the little cartoon at the beginning makes it all worth it, the two tape drives yes. kind of conspiring on how they can grab all of your money.
It's great, though. It's a really, really good video and just wonderfully retro in a big iron way. So,
it's only 10 minutes, so or 11, so it's not a big commitment.
Maybe it's I watched more than one then, because I watched one that definitely went on for over an hour. So, well, we'll link to the U.S. National Archives, and there's a bunch in there, so there must be another IRS video that goes on quite a lot longer about their mainframe things. I ended up watching four or five of them, and they're really fascinating. So then diving into a couple of notes about upcoming and just past retro events, we talked about the Retro Computer Museum having a Easter weekend open house of sorts, and so somebody walked through that with a video camera and has posted it on YouTube, so we will have that link. I will warn you, turn off your audio. They have chosen to embed a funky techno soundtrack to it that I found a little less than appropriate. I was like, what is this music? But the visuals are fantastic. So if you couldn't be there at the Retro Computer Museum this last weekend, then this will show you what you missed. And of course, upcoming next is an event that we talked about, I think on the last show as well. VCF Southeast 2.0 will be happening very shortly, May 3 to 4. So I think that is next weekend, probably?
Next weekend, yes.
It's about to go. There is a Kickstarter going for that right now as well. It hasn't yet been funded, but it's one of those things where really it's a way to get goodies ahead of time. You can get your tickets through that and reserve tickets, reserve T-shirts, and that sort of thing. So if you are thinking of going, then this might be a nice way to get your entrance in there and grab yourself a T-shirt or what have you, and then make sure that it gets funded. But the event will be happening regardless of whether the Kickstarter is successful or not. So now we get to turn to the part of the show where we talk, and I guess we'll have to keep it relatively brief, about things we can buy, mostly things we can buy for me, and something, I'm going to pick a little tiny thing that you all could buy for me. Under $6 will be my retro computing host gift choice, and it is a computer floppy disk rubber stamp. It's just a little stamp that you can ink up yourself, and there's a few of these. The person, it's over on Etsy, person makes a few different interesting stamps. You can get a computer arrow, you can get a newer fangled floppy disk, but I like this one. It's the image of an old 5 1/4 inch floppy disk, and you just ink up your stamp, you stamp it down, you can stamp an image that appears in a lot of people's word processors, but a lot of those people now look at those and go, I wonder what that shape is. So if you want to be able to tell people what are these things that we used to store data on and that we now, in next week, will be discussing how the heck you can get your data back off, I think it's a wonderful little stamp. It really intrigued me. So that's what I'm picking. $5.75. Nice and cheap. Handmade rubber stamp. Floppy to put floppy disks on other people's foreheads. Could be a fun
game. Yeah, I love it. Analog disk image.
It is very nice, Michael. Very nice. You win
it's
this podcast.
Sided.
Oh,
yes, it's
you're all excellent.
It's got the flippies.
It does indeed. It's got the notch on both sides, so you can stamp the other side of the paper as well. So now let's turn to eBay auctions. So what are we selecting for eBays? Michael, let's start with you. What is your choice for eBay auction of the week?
Well, I thought that seeing that we were talking about the 360 mainframe turning 50 years old, what better than to have your own piece of mainframe media? So rush out there and buy yourself some 8-track magnetic tape.
Nice. And what's it going for?
$30.
What can I do with it?
US? Well, you could use it as a crime scene tape. You could
use it to impress your friends.
And the thing is, if your friends are the right friends, it will impress your friends.
No. The irony is, of all my retro computer collection, including a stinking PDP sitting there, the thing that impressed my family the most was showing them this tape reel. They're looking at that. Ooh, that looks like old computer stuff. That's really cool. Where'd you get that? I'm like, wow, I haven't been able to impress you with anything. But this tape reel, just for some reason, it said, you know, old computer to them.
Yeah, so. eight inch floppy disks and tape reels. That gets them every time.
I agree. So next, I guess, is me, and I am going to select something that really caught my eye by Dr. Steve Buggy. Now, I met him briefly at Kansas Fest last year. He does the battery, this big external battery, or a battery replacement for an Apple II. But this new project caught my eye, and it's the Apple IIc Battery Portability Kit. And so I was fascinated by this. If you want to run your Apple IIe out in the woods, perhaps, or not connected to the mains, this lets you run a 2C off any 12-volt DC source. Now, it has to be specifically a 2C, not any other 2 model, including not the 2C Plus, because the 2C is one of the few that can take, through its power supply, just a, basically, I think it's 9 to 16-volt DC, and that's it. It doesn't require the plus 12 and the minus 12 and the plus 5 and the minus 5. It's just, here's what I need, and it's only the 2C. So, Mr. Buggy said, well, then let's come up with the cables and the bits you need that you can connect to any 12-volt source, including like a little battery booster pack or a little portable thing, and you can run yourself a 2C. I think it's really neat. So if, for instance, you're traveling the world and you're Winnebago or something, you got an RV, here's how you can power an Apple II. I think this is just delightful. It's only $19 for the kit. I think it sounds well worth it. He also announces in the eBay listing that he will be at Kansas Fest this year, and we'll have them there, and we'll be demonstrating it. So I think it's all looks
awesome.
On
your way to Kansas Fest, you could have your 2C with a text-based NavMan software running.
Exactly. See, this kind of stuff. I'm really excited about the idea of being able to operate a 2C, an actual full-on 2C, like in a car, and that sort of idea. So anyway, that is my choice. Really caught my eye. I think it sounds very cool. So Earl,
will it work with that cool monitor that goes with the 2C?
I don't know about that one, but it will work with some monitors. In fact, in this listing, he specifically talks about 12-volt television, 12-volt displays that exist, and the one in particular that's shown here that he got and where to buy that from and that he's had a lot of success with. So there are 12-volt monitors and displays you can use as well.
Very cool.
Yeah. So, Earl, what have you selected for eBay?
Well, one of the big complaints about the ZX81 was the keyboard, right? Mm-hmm. And so here is an outboard keyboard along with a ZX81 computer that the person doesn't know exactly whether it functions or not. I get the feeling they didn't know enough about this particular Sinclair model to really run it through a test.
But it shows a TV with characters on it.
I know. So something's working. Maybe they just didn't know BASIC, which harkens us back to the beginning of the show, that you really should know BASIC enough to test.
I'll send them a link to the show notes.
I'd never seen one of these before.
Me,
I thought it was fascinating.
Neither. This is totally fascinating. I never knew there was an external keyboard option.
And it's not a Sinclair part. as far as I can tell, they call it a KD, K-A-Y-D-E, but it looks like an aftermarket add-on. Apparently, somewhere under the hood, you had to hook this thing up because they say that now the membrane keyboard on the computer doesn't work anymore. Only the external keyboard.
No loss.
Right. And it makes sense to me. I mean, you probably had to hack the thing inside to make this work.
Or disconnect that connection and this is connecting instead. But looks like a much more pleasant keyboard to be typing on.
But isn't that cool? Because the computer itself was actually a fun amount of processing power for the amount that you paid for it. The things were just dirt cheap. So then you get one of these little hack-on keyboards and you could be doing some real computing. So I liked it. And I thought this GBP 550 was not a bad price for it at the moment, although it is newly listed. It's still got 4 days and 22 hours.
Yeah, but still, only at less than six pounds at the moment. Nice.
Mm. And the leather texture on the external keyboard is so 80s.
That's true. I didn't notice. Awesome. That makes it all the better.
How many vinyls died to make that skin?
Many. They were hunting the vinyls. Okay, Paul, are you going to keep the tradition alive and pick six or seven different things?
I think I will just I will pick just as I was looking through relatively quickly this time, there was a K-Pro 2 that showed up that seemed like it didn't cost too much and looked nice and in good shape. So I kind of like these. I like things that don't take up a huge amount of space. Mm-hmm. And the nice thing about these K-Pro 2s is that they don't. I fear that I may have picked a K-Pro 2 like once or twice in the past, but this is a different auction.
Right. And very clean.
It's very clean.
It looks new.
The screen comes up, it says, please put in a disc. That's often the part where it stops working and you need to fix it, but at least it gets that far.
I think it stops working because of a failure with the drives. I had one of these almost exactly like this and could not get the drives to work. Did all the traditional stuff that you can do without an oscilloscope to try to recondition the drives, and it just wasn't going to happen. One thing that I'll say about the K-Pro 2s, they are exceedingly simple. If you pop the hood on this thing and look underneath, the way that they've got the boards, you've got the main processor board that's virtually a single board computer, and then the video board with the circuitry to drive the monitor, and that's pretty much it. So, and the chips are fairly straightforward too. So if you can get the drives to work, one of these things ought to be in pretty good shape for you.
I think they are actually fairly they're fairly standard for that era drives too, like the Tandon. It's the same things I think that were in the IBM PC.
Yeah, I was able to successfully replace them with some half-height drives, and the particular ROM in the one that I had would take double-sided drives, even though it shipped with single-sided. But it looked funny when you opened it up and you see half of the drive bay just sitting there empty. And so it wasn't worth it to me to keep that. I sold it. But yeah, watch out for the drives, because from what I read, they seem to be a fairly common failure point. It's better if the seller says, yeah, I booted it up, and it actually booted. Then you could be a little bit more confident.
Yeah, this is probably on it's about at the limit of the price I'd probably suggest for this. I wouldn't go too much higher than where it starts.
Right, because you can normally get one for 100, 150 or so that shows it running something from the floppy. So, but $50, sure. That sounds like a good deal.
Yeah.
So what's your other choice, Paul?
You have more. Yeah, I did actually. The other one I was looking at was a Duo Dock, which is, it's sort of an interesting. There was a point in Apple's laptop history when they made a very small, for the time, but actually even now, a very small laptop called the Duo, and they actually made a dock for it that would turn it into a desktop machine. You could slide it in. It operates sort of like a if you remember VHS tapes, it operates.
It's front loading. Like that is true. I had a couple of Duos actually, and I had a Duo dock.
Yep. Mm. It's a pretty cool thing.
I've still got a couple of PowerBook Duos and a Duo dock. They're very interesting.
Mm-hmm. I like to dock in. I like the idea. Well, one, you got that, like, you know, when you're on your desktop, you're going to use the full computer, and when you're on the road, you get something really small. And it's always been the ideal of portable computing. Often when I've gone for the tiny laptop as my main computer, you get an error or something. At your desk, though, you want to use the big computer or the big monitor. You want to use the full-size keyboard and mouse. And so the Duo Dock was the idea behind that. And I like that it had its own, if I recall, its own coprocessor in the dock. Yep. So when it was docked, you actually had a more powerful computer.
And also extra hard drive. So it was a very, very great piece of hardware.
Yeah, I agree. I remember it. I remember liking it very much, loving the Duo, and being very sad when they went away because there was nothing really that small for quite a while. And loving my Duo dock too. And I also had a different dock now that I forgot all about now that would just clip on the back. It was a much smaller dock made by a third party that would have an Ethernet connection and something. Do you know what that was?
Yeah, almost like a port replicator.
Yeah.
I can't remember the brand, but yeah, I've got the ones that this clip onto the back with the network connection and,
yeah,
and SCSI connections and everything,
like
as well.
Faircom thing or something. Yeah, but I forgot all about those. So, Paul, into my life.
Yeah, those for when you're traveling around, chuck them in the bag with along with the computer and this one on your desk back at the office.
I remember that too. That's exactly what I had. This is exactly my setup. This was many years ago, and I had forgotten all about this thing. I loved my Duo Dock.
Didn't this thing actually eject the computer when you
There's a button on the right hand side.
I snickered.
It is a VCR.
Quite a bit. The first time when I saw this, because you had the Macintoshes from way back when that when you'd eject the drive, it'd go, you know, kind of kick it out. I remember I saw one of these in the guy's office. He's like, hey, watch this. You know, he kicks out the whole computer. I'm like, now that is an eject button.
Nice choice. This is a nice choice, Paul. And only $25 at the moment with no bids. So, geez. Yeah,
it
seems like a steal.
It has a lock,
right?
Or is this the computer
plus the dock?
No, it's even though the title is kind of confusing, but it there is no Duo. You need to get the Duo also separately. The other thing is it has a lock, as far as I can tell, the key is not provided. I think you would need the key to lock it, so you're probably safe. But you know, one of the things to keep an eye on. Keep an eye out for with this.
Yeah, I think it's the plus is because this is the Duo Dock Plus. There was a normal Duo Dock, and then the plus. There was the Duo Dock 2, and the Duo Dock Plus. And for the life of me, I can't remember the difference between them. I think the plus was the one that came with the hard drive, and the regular ones didn't. Maybe.
I think that's nice.
There is something. I had the last Duo. I actually have a couple now that you know, they were the first PowerPC machine, and I think they only work with the Duo Dock 2. So there's a little bit of a compatibility. If you already have a Duo, this might be just art for you, unless you have the right Duo for the Duo Dock Plus.
Yeah, I had one of the passive display Duos. I'd like the Duo 230 or something. And then later one of the color ones, either like the 270C, 280C, some number like, and then I too had the one that was it was a longer number, like the 2300C, I think it was called, was that Duo. And that was the last Duo I had. I like the Duo line.
Yeah, no, I did too. Even though we're way over time, I will quickly say that I got one, I think it was probably 1990, whenever they came out. And I loved it so much, I could carry it around. I'd throw it in my bag, like a notebook, and I'd sort of, you know, bring it with me. And I think within about a week, I had dropped it off a counter, and the screen cracked like right in half. There was like basically a quarter of the screen that was still functional. I was very depressed about this. I brought it back to Apple, the computer store that I got it from. They shipped it back. You know, I said, you know, well, just see what you can do. They replaced it for free. I have no idea why they did this. It was completely my fault that the thing fell. But I got, you know, I ultimately had it replaced for me. And after that, I never took it outside again, which is, you know, so the whole point of having the thing was that it was portable, but I was scared to death of it at that point.
That's so funny. I love the Duo. I suspect if I was to pick up a Duo today, I would be shocked at how heavy and thick it actually is. My memory is it was tiny, but laptops have come a long way in smallness and lightness the last couple of years. So let's see. Interesting. And very interesting choices, Paul.
You're right, actually. I'm holding one now, and it is pretty heavy.
Compared to, like, a MacBook Air, say, or a netbook. Yeah. So then I guess we're going to go to closing discussions, wrap up this slightly long show. I blame the host for the length. Oh, that's me. I am going to point everybody to the mother of all demos. Maybe this is something we talked about before. Maybe we didn't. I came across it again recently. It's from 1968. Douglas Engelbart is giving a demo of some computer technology, and I forgot how impressive and remarkable this is, because it's from 1968, and he does a demo showing computer mouse, word processing, hypertext, multiple windows on the computer. It's just like, by the way, here's everything you can do for the next 30 years, all in one demo. It's totally remarkable that this is from 1968. So if you haven't seen it, it's really worth checking out. So that's what I'm going to use as my anything to add. And then let's now, I guess, go around the table. Earl, what's up with you? What else have you got to add to wrap up our show?
Well, I completely agree on the mother of all demos, by the way. The only thing I wish is that the folks who digitized this would at some point upload a slightly higher resolution copy, because it's a 240p up on YouTube. And it's, if you blow it up to full screen, some of the things that Doug Engelbart is demonstrating get a little bit fuzzy. And I don't know if the original film is fuzzy like that or if it's just the quality of the video that's on YouTube. So I wish we had a better quality copy of it. But aside from that, yeah, if you haven't seen that, oh my gosh, you've got to go see that. In terms of what's going on with me, I saw something come across the CC Tech mailing list about some deck books that were available. So I went and I did a rescue. I got 10 boxes of deck binders. And they're the incredibly bright, kind of gaudy orange color binders. Do you guys remember those? If you'd walk into a deck computer center, you'd have either the wall of gray or the wall of orange or whatever. And I love those. I'd actually gone out to Office Depot and some other online sites to see if I could find binders that would match that color. But now I've got a bunch of them. I'm going to run through them and see if there's any of the documents I've got that aren't on BitSavers or one of the other deck archives. I'm going to try and find someone in the area that may have a page feed scanner so that we could get those things up there.
Cool.
Yeah, at least they're three-ring bound, right? So they're actually probably fairly easy to scan quickly.
That's right. You could take them out of the binder, scan them through a normal, if you had a sheet feeder with a duplexer so it could scan both sides, then that would be awesome. And there's got to be somebody in Portland here in the retro community who has access to something like that. So maybe I can archive some documents, but, you know, at a minimum, I've got a bunch of the cool old deck binders, which I love.
Yeah, I recall those from the, you know, the computer room and at college, and I've always loved them. I fear that I at one point I did salvage some like old ones from the computer room when they no longer needed them. I'm pretty sure that's how I got them, but at any rate, I'm not completely sure I kept them. Now I wish I had, but because they really are iconic.
Mm-hmm. I agree, and so, Michael, as far as I can tell from the show notes, you've got nothing to contribute.
I have nothing to say, no. Retro Me has come to a grinding halt, rebooting soon.
Right. Got it. Well, we hope Retro You has something to contribute soon. And meanwhile, you can just go play more basic stuff. And then what about you, Paul? What have you got to wrap up our, to finish the show with?
So actually I have a couple of things that I have just recently gotten a hold of that I'm interested in playing with. I spent a little bit of time the last couple of days working with this disk imaging stuff that we'll talk about next time. So, but if you recall, I think on the last show I pointed out this large Heathkit lot of like a bunch of trainers and some of the documentation and so forth. And I pointed it out. It ended. It got relisted. I waited a little bit, but I actually managed to get it. The guy took an offer, and so
nice.
I now have the ETA 3400, which is the relatively hard to find IO expander for this trainer. I tried plugging it in. The trainer works. The trainer will go up to its boot up CPU up state, but the when I plug in the memory unit, I just get sort of garbled display. So I have to do some troubleshooting, but it's really quite cool. The one of the things that came with it was a Heathkit binder that had the continuing education information in it, and I opened it up, and you know, there's it's, you know, lessons and so forth. But one of the things that I thought was very cool about it was inside the binder there was an envelope with a bunch of flexi discs that you play on a record player. You know, to
I remember like, those.
I had no idea that even such things existed, but it's very interesting. So I'm going to play around with that. And the other thing that showed up recently was a fairly beat up old Atari 800 that I finally got one of these things.
I want one. I'm jealous.
It is oh boy, was that dirty. And actually it also broke into a couple different pieces when I was trying to, like, I think it got damaged somewhat in shipping, but it is now in more pieces than it should be.
That's more than one.
What you put on that, and I thought, you know, it's interesting because the experience that I had with the Atari 800s is that they were pretty rugged. So I wonder if the plastic is just denaturing over the years, or if, like you say, maybe it got banged around a bit on its way to you.
I think it's probably a little of both. I tried to clean out the keyboard. On the keyboard, the Atari 800 keyboard has a number of special keys on the left. I think it's the left, where, you know, maybe it's the right. I guess it's the right. It's the left from the back.
Right, the select, the reset. Yeah. Right.
They're held in by little clips, and those clips, I lost. I'm sad to say that it had more clips, you know, attached when I started than it does now. I tried to be so careful with those, but they were very, very brittle. And I wanted to get the keys out because they were just awful. But I'm going to have to try to figure out what to do to solve that. But I'm
jealous.
Quite excited.
Yeah. That is, I think, of every computer that I've never owned, like of all the many, many computers that have never passed through my hands, the Atari 800 is the one that I kind of pine for the most. I know nothing about Atari computers, like nothing. I don't even know like what disk stuff that you like, nothing at all. Complete noob when it comes to Atari. But the Atari 800, the original one, that form factor, I adore it. I really, really want to get my hands on one of these things eventually. I think it's really calling to me. Listen to the Antic podcast. And they keep talking about them, and it just makes me really want an Atari.
Yeah, that's about as far as I've gotten to knowing Atari. I at least listen to that podcast all the time.
Right, exactly, me too. So that's my experience as well. So nice finds all around. Well done, Paul. Okay, and then that brings us to the end of the show. You will, as always, find all of the men show notes over at our website, which is rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss this over at the Vintage Computer Forum. We'll have a link to that on rcrpodcast.com. Unsurprisingly, you could follow us on Twitter, that newfangled thing. Yeah, we hang out there. Earl reads your tweets. You can find us there at rcrpodcast. You should follow us. We're very interesting people. That's Earl tweeting, by the way. You can send us feedback directly. If you're not down with Twitter, maybe you're down with the email, you can simply send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com, or if you just remember the website, rcrpodcast.com, there's a link on there to send us email directly. We are proud members of the Throwback Network. Everybody salute. And if you want to support the show, best thing you could possibly do is give us a big old 5-star rating on iTunes so other people can find it and enjoy it as well. Inflict our podcast on others. And now, say it with me, folks, until next time, retro compute. Well done, fellows. Ever find my way.